agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. Today, I am interviewing Paul Brandis, who is an independent member of the White House Press Corps since 2008, and who I originally knew via his West Wing reports at West Wing Report. He is a writer and columnist for publications including USA Today, and his books include Books in the Presidency, Under This Roof, more recently, This Day in Presidential History. Paul, it is wonderful to welcome a fellow presidential observer to the Politics Guys. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Trey.
Well, it's always a lot of fun because I sometimes feel a little bit left out on the politics, guys. We've got all different kinds of experts, but I'm the only guy who does communication and politics. So I was really excited for us to be the ones to get to connect today for this interview. And this week, of course, we've had some really interesting things going on when it comes to communication with Elon Musk's potential takeover buyout of Twitter. So, Paul, I got a lot of things I'd like to chat with you about today, and so we'll get into as much of it as we can. Mm-hmm. But one of the areas I really want to start with is, you know, you've done a lot of work assessing presidents, and specifically, I've read your stuff on former President Trump, which is always a hot topic here on the Politics Guys. And in your own words, when you were assessing Trump, as you put it, you quote, "I wasn't totally harsh on Trump. I put him in the bottom third. Still lousy, but not a total disaster in two categories, public persuasion and economic management." In that case, he finished 32nd and 34th, the end of your quote. And I would love to probe your thinking on this a little bit. You know, today we see that Trump, I mean, he's convinced huge swaths of Republicans, both general voters and his party. I mean, take a look at what's going on with McCarthy, of his claims to kind of move and to change. Do you think that we rank Trump too lowly overall, specifically when it comes, as you were putting it there, to persuasion? What do you think about Trump and his persuasive powers?
Well, the 10 categories that we used at C-SPAN, and just to step back a little bit, C-SPAN, I think, invited maybe about 100, I don't know the exact number, maybe 100 historians roughly around the country, authors, journalists. So I fall into a couple of categories there. And they judge every time there's a new president. So in other words, they did this when Biden came in, and they previously did it when Trump came in and 2017 and so forth. Every time there's a new president, they redo the survey. And there are 10 categories that they ask us to grade all of the presidents on. And it's no surprise that the presidents at the top, it's the usual folks, Lincoln, George Washington, FDR, those kind of things. And they'll probably always be at the top. The interesting thing is to see who moves around in kind of the middle tier and who moves up or down, as the case may be, kind of lower in the ranks. This was the first time that Trump was ranked. And there, again, mm-hmm. the 10 categories. One of them, if you want to zero in on that, is what is a public persuasion. That was one of his better categories. I think, in fact, it was his best category. I'm looking at it now.
Yes.
He ranked 32nd. You know, the most persuasive president, I think, was FDR. We could have a whole discussion about the Roosevelts. But 32nd, and I think that is an okay number. You have to temper that with a couple of things. I mean, the president, you know, whether you liked the former president or you despised the former president, and obviously there are both. This is a deeply divided country. There are folks on both sides of the fence. Even the folks who admire President Trump acknowledge that he is not the most honest president. He told he did not tell the truth about a lot of things. There's another way of saying did not tell the truth. He told falsehoods, also known as lies, about all kinds of things. And again, whether you like the president or not, I think people can acknowledge that. And the most the biggest enduring example of that, I think, is this ongoing claim about the 2020 election. I honestly think that it's harder to place him higher in the public persuasive category, because frankly, persuasiveness, there are subcategories of persuasiveness, Trey, that I think are important. And those are things like honesty and credibility and integrity. And when you're on the record of saying things that frankly aren't true, it doesn't really help with the persuasion, because what you really have are a lot of people who go, well, but he lied about X and Y and Z. How can I trust what he's saying about this or that? So that cuts into the public persuasion ranking, I think. That being said, 32 out of 45, he is in kind of at the bottom of the middle tier, but not the bottom tier.
I like how you're kind of talking there about the persuasion includes elements of honesty in that sense. So let me ask you this, because again, you know, you early on use Twitter to report on the way, long before presidents were using it in a meaningful way back in 2008. Hmm. What do you think about then in terms, let's kind of pull back from just the persuasion portion of it. What do you think about Donald Trump's use of social media? So maybe we don't call that persuasion, but I've often wondered if we didn't underestimate his ability to use social media in a powerful and important way that propelled him forward, and maybe has not fared as well when he's been cut off from that access.
Well, there are two things that I think, well, three things really, that helped Donald Trump get elected in the first place. The first was that he was a public figure, a well-known, long before he announced his candidacy in 2015. Of course, he had the TV show The Apprentice, which was on NBC for years and years and years. NBC at the time, the guy who greenlighted that show was a guy named Jeff Zucker, who until recently was the head of CNN. And when Trump announced his candidacy in 2015, there were not a lot of people who thought he had a chance of winning. They saw it as kind of a, you know, marketing thing for his Trump brand and the golf courses and the clubs and, you know, the hotels rather, and all of that. But nevertheless, when he started to do well, he did well in Iowa and New Hampshire, and then it was off to the races after the first caucus and debate and so forth. People started to take him a bit more seriously, and that leads us to the second thing that helped him tremendously. And for all of his vitriol against non-Fox networks like CNN, for example, CNN covered almost everything he did from start to finish. In other words, they gave him tons of what is called earned media, free media time. They covered rallies from beginning to end. And I mentioned the name Jeff Zucker because when he was heading CNN, he left just a couple of months ago. When he was running CNN, he saw Trump in terms of entertainment value. He was this tremendous entertainment value on The Apprentice at NBC. CNN thought he could be of tremendous entertainment value again at CNN. Boy, you never really know what Trump is going to say. He's entertaining. He's bombastic. He's loud. He's boisterous. He's all of, pick your adjective, he's all of these things. So Zucker and CNN decided that they would give him start to finish coverage of all kinds of events. You can't buy that kind. It would cost a fortune to buy advertising on these networks. They gave it to him for free. So that's the second thing that really propelled him, is that he got tons of free time on television networks that he later came to criticize for covering him in ways that he didn't like. The third thing, to come back to social media, is he had a huge account on Twitter, huge account on Facebook. And for a politician, any politician, the joy of social media is that it allows you to bypass reporters asking pesky questions, that kind of thing. It allows you to bypass editors who take a 30-minute speech and, just for reasons of time, you know, chop it up into a 15-second soundbite. It allows you to bypass all of that. And for any politician, that is really amazing. So he had a national platform thanks to The Apprentice. It got stronger and more pervasive because of Jeff Zucker and CNN, and then, of course, the social media platforms that he had. You know, social media, people have different views about, is it good or is it bad? I think binary choices like that are not really the way to go. Geez, is it good or is it bad? Is it up or is it down? Is it liberal? Is it Democrat? Or is it liberal or conservative? Is it Republican or Democrat? Binary choices like that, things are usually more nuanced than that. Social media is actually neither good or bad. They're simply agnostic platforms that exist, and it's up to individuals and corporations. What these platforms are what people make of them. You can use it for good or ill. You can use it to raise awareness after a hurricane, please send help to the Gulf Coast, something like that. Or you can use it to say things that aren't true during a campaign, edit a video out of context, put it on these platforms, and then, of course, it spreads. I'm not necessarily talking about Trump here. All sorts of politicians on both sides of the aisle have abused these platforms, knowing that most voters either aren't paying close attention or they're not particularly well informed, and other reasons. There are a lot of politicians, Republicans and Democrats, who have abused this. But to say that social media itself is good or bad, no, it's just a platform. And it depends on how people use it. It's really what a guy named Newton Minow said probably 60 years ago about television. He was one of the early commissioners of the Federal Communications Commission, and he gave a famous speech about television. And he said, television has the power to educate, to inform, to bring us together. Or it could just be lights and wires in a box. It depends on how individuals use it. The same principle really is true for social media. It can be used for good or ill, depending on the nature of the person who's using it. And again, I'll emphasize, I'm not necessarily talking about President Trump, former President Trump here, but lots of politicians have abused it. Lots of say investment types have you. We could have a discussion all day long about the ups and downs of people in the public sector and private sector abusing these platforms.
You know, it's interesting. One, I think you're absolutely right when you talk about the amount of free media time that Trump gets. Now, and you talk about the platform, and I think a lot of times there's always a tendency when we have new things to develop, new platforms to develop, we want to kind of be, I don't want to say we're Luddites in that sense, but rather that there's can be trepidation. And we say, well, it's either going to, it's going to cause everything, right? As you put it in kind of that binary choice, it's either going to be this perfect unmitigated good, or it's going to be this terrible evil. But oftentimes it's going to have kind of more structural, systematic changes. And so when you're talking about television and now as looking forward to the way it which works in social media, I'm thinking to the classic work, Amusing Ourselves to Death, where there's this idea that the platform television itself tends to move, it has structural moves for how we're going to engage with it. So what do you see as being the structural changes that social media brings forward, and how does that interact with the way that presidents are governing? You started to hint at that, and I would like you to move in that a little bit more, Paul.
Well, the you know, things are much faster today. We have what's known as a news cycle, and people here talk about, oh, winning the news cycle. The news cycle has been compressed to, well, 10 years ago, it was compressed to maybe 24 hours. And now there seems to be a continuous news cycle where things happen so quickly and they're posted on these social media platforms quickly. And it seems to increase the pressure on presidents to respond to things faster. And I'm not quite sure that's a healthy thing. In fact, I'm convinced it's not, because the media and voters, individuals may move at one speed. We want things resolved right away. When you have serious, complex, globally intertwined issues, there are things that actually necessitate pause that presidents must take for reflection and consultation with advisors, and sometimes just time to think about things. So the pace at which politicians sometimes need to move often don't match up or dovetail, if you will, with the speed and the expectations with which consumers and the media expect that politicians are going to respond to things. Does the president have something happened at 10 a.m.? Does the president have a reaction to this? It just happened, you know, that kind of a thing. So I think that the best presidents are those in this modern age who try and unplug from that and take the time they need to deliberate serious issues that are deeply complex in ways that maybe, again, superficial reporters and voters, frankly, might, no disrespect, but they're perhaps not paying as close attention, or reporters with a deadline, you know, a 4 o'clock deadline, demand an answer to something for which there might not be an answer just yet. So you have these conflicting forces at work here, with different time frames at work and so forth. And that's the disconnect. So I think that politicians who kind of understand that can operate a little bit better. You know, there's an interesting story coming back to the early 60s, which I was mentioning before with Newton Minow. People don't remember this, but one of the first things that John F. Kennedy did when he came to the White House, he asked, well, how many of these famous fireside chats did Franklin Roosevelt do? And people don't know this. Roosevelt only gave about 30 fireside chats in 12 years. He really only appeared before the public two or three times a year. And there were really only two big issues during the Roosevelt presidency. There was the Depression, and then there was World War II. Talk about giant issues, and yet he rarely appeared. And Kennedy, that was sort of a validation for President Kennedy, because he realized that, and this is hard to believe in the year 2022, but Kennedy said that if I go on, president can obviously go on television whenever he wants, but Kennedy said, if I go on television too much, I'm going to be a bore. I don't want to bore people. I'll go on only when there's something very serious to talk about, sort of what like FDR did with the Depression and World War II. Talk about, again, two huge issues, and yet Roosevelt was rarely seen. Kennedy understood that. Other presidents have done pretty well in that regard, too. Ronald Reagan, who grew up a Democrat and grew up idolizing Roosevelt, also did the same thing. Both Kennedy and Reagan, as an aside, by the way, both gave FDR all the credit in the world for the great communicators that they became, too. It's really interesting. We talk about sort of the communication style of these presidents all day long. So the problem is sometimes the past presidents who I've mentioned understood that, you know, you don't want to go on television very often. You know, You know what they say, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, it's just as true for politicians as it is for anyone else. So FDR rarely appeared. Kennedy rarely appeared. Reagan did not appear that much either. But then you have in the social media age, again, as I mentioned, this much faster cycle where people expect to hear from the president right away about every single issue. Well, you had President Trump, who was a creature of Twitter. He'd be tweeting all day long, morning, noon, and night on Twitter. You can ask yourself, and again, it's a deeply divided country and everybody has a different opinion, whether that kind of familiarity breeds contempt. Trump wanted to be on television all the time. He wanted to be on Twitter all the time. He thinks it was good for him. Some people think it was good for him. Others, not so much. Again, it's not a binary thing. There are probably some nuances to that discussion. So there are conflicting forces at work in terms of the speed with which social media and television work today, but the speed with which politicians, presidents in particular, need to really think about issues that frankly can't be solved in 30 minutes or something like that.
Oftentimes for my students, we talk about, retrospectively, I think there's this idea that FDR was on every week, right? That he was this kind of constant presence. And that just is not the case. You're absolutely right. As I look forward and you take a look, so you move forward to the George W. Bush era, and then you take a look at the Obama era, you have individuals who, George W. Bush, he was not part of social media. Matter of fact, did not want to send emails in the White House. We don't even have a White House website until you get to Clinton. And even then, it's more of a sideshow thing than it's any kind of meaningful part of a communication strategy. So you start, in a big way covering the White House in 2008. So you're right on the beginning of presidents using social media as being part of their strategy in a smaller way. Including, Obama is the first individual to have a staff that includes a social media director inside of their communications office. What have been, besides the speeds, some of the other things that you've seen develop in presidential communication from 08 to from here until now in 2022?
Well, I think the principal change has been the lesser importance of the White House press corps, of which I've been, as I think, a member going on, 14, 15 years now. And that's not such a bad thing. Presidents, frankly, don't need us as much as they used to for the reasons that I mentioned. They can go around us whenever they want simply by hitting the send button and reaching the American people directly. That can be both good and bad. It's good from their standpoint because they can get their message out completely unfiltered and directly to the public, which sounds okay, except what if you have, all politicians, Biden, Trump, Obama, Bush, Clinton, it's not a partisan thing. They all do this. All presidents obviously try and spin things in the most positive way they can. One thing that the reporters do is they often push back on that and they ask questions about this that maybe politicians don't want to answer. So having a free and unfettered channel to the American public sounds okay. But then what if you have a politician who is kind of spinning something or taking it out of context? And again, they all do it. Reporters sometimes can push back and say, well, is that really true? What about this data point over here that says otherwise? Can you clarify something like that? So reporters are there to kind of they call them the watchdog of the government. So sometimes people, it's really interesting that, when I was, in the White House press room every day during the Obama presidency, you know, reporters would be criticized for either A, being too tough on Obama, or B, not being tough enough on Obama. And then when Trump came in, of course, it was the same thing. Reporters were either too tough on Trump or not tough enough on Trump. But what's interesting is that, you know, the people making these accusations simply changed sides. The people who said that reporters were too tough on Obama said the opposite about Trump and so forth. So there's very kind of a partisan tinge to it. So in other words, if you were an Obama supporter, you thought people weren't being tough on Trump. But then if you hated Obama, you thought people were being too tough on Trump. So that kind of thing. So, you know, reporters are, it's damned if you do and damned if you don't. But that's just the way it is. And if you go to work as a member of the White House press corps, this is just part of the job. You know, I think you're going to piss people off. And if you can, my philosophy has always been, Trey, that if you're irritating both sides, then you're probably doing okay. If you're irritating, you know, everyone, then that's probably a sign that you're probably being, you know, pretty fair about it. But I've gotten nasty emails and phone calls and so forth from people who said either I was a stooge for Obama or a stooge for Trump. Or on the other hand, I've gotten emails from people who said, you know, you're in bed with Obama or you're in bed with Trump. And well, if I get messages from people on both sides accusing me of that kind of thing, well, yeah, I guess that means I'm not one or the other. But people perceive what they want to, you know, perceive. So there's really not that much you can do. You just try and, you know, reporters are human and you do the best you can, but you're never going to please people. And that's sort of not what the job is about anyway.
Kind of sounds like we've got the bipartisan hate mail thesis emerging, right? You know, you're doing your job if the hate mail's coming in about equal from both sides. Now, you talked early in the interview about some of the biggest lies from Trump. And I know that one of the things that our listeners oftentimes struggle with on our front is, well, how do you be balanced when you've got an individual like President Trump, former President Trump versus Biden, somebody who's a little bit more fits the box of what you'd expect? As you've covered the transition from the Trump presidency to the Biden presidency, how has that shift been as a cover and a reporter?
Well, all presidents say things that aren't true. I think the biggest lie of the Obama era, for example, was the famous, you know, if you like your health plan, you can keep your health plan, that was said, you know, 10, 12 years ago in the run-up to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. That didn't turn out to be so. In fact, a PolitiFact called what Obama said, it was the lie of the year. So again, all politicians do that. Trump lied too. He just lied about more things and on a bigger scale. But when I say that, again, that doesn't make me, you know, this or that. I'm simply pointing out something that is factually true. I mentioned that Obama Obama lied about big things. Trump lied about big things, just more of the time and about more things. In terms of Biden, I think Biden's principal problem is, you know, it's a problem that's dogged him his whole career. He tends to put his foot in his mouth and say things that are kind of foolish, and his defenders say, oh, that's just Joe being Joe. Leave him alone. Like last week, he was out on the West Coast on Earth. He had some Earth Day events in Seattle, and he was talking about his Corvette. He's a car guy. That's fine. He likes cars. That's fine. But he was talking about his Corvette on Earth Day, and he was saying, oh, all it does is just pollute the air. You know, it's a terrible, that's not exactly the kind of thing that a president who's worried about climate change, wants to say on Earth Day. It was a stupid thing for him to say. So his biggest issue is sort of he tends to put his foot in his mouth. And that's something that's dogged him, frankly, his entire career. But he's also said things that have been dishonest, too. Just things that he doesn't quite have his facts straight or he's been wrong about this. There's a difference, though, in terms of, and again, I'm not taking sides here. I think President Trump was more blatant in things he said that weren't true. And perhaps Biden is a little more subtle in the things he says that aren't true. It's so in other words, he's more of a typical politician in that he's more subtle in the things he says that aren't true. Whereas Trump was just he would just come out and say things. And I think Trump always packaged his dishonesty and what he called a truthful hyperbole, which was a very interesting turn of phrase.
You know, you've also written, and I, you know, to kind of continue this thought on Biden, that Biden is kind of the historic corrective to the Trump presidency, this historic precedent of being good presidents following bad. You said at the beginning of the Biden presidency, and obviously you're offering, you know, the foot in the mouth assessment as being some of the downfalls that has dogged Biden. As we approach the midterm, the public is going to begin to kind of have its first assessment of the Biden presidency. What's your assessment of the Biden presidency as we get into the end of its first 2 years?
Well, the pendulum swings back and forth in this country. We have Biden before that. We had Trump before that. We had Obama. Before that, we had George W. Bush. And before that, we had Bill Clinton. The pendulum has swung back and forth over the decades between a Republican and a Democrat, between liberal and conservative, and that kind of thing. So when I say it's not a return to normalcy from Trump to Biden, it's just the pendulum. And as we approach the midterms, there's no question that I think Republicans are going to take back the House. No question about it. History and frankly, the math suggests that it's going to be pretty easy for them. They only need, I think, about 5 seats in the House to take over. And historically, in midterms, the number that the party that is out of power wins in midterms is actually much more than that. So history, the small margin, and frankly, the president's low approval number, he's about, 41%, mm-hmm. I think, as we speak, in both aggregate polls, the Real Clear Politics poll and the 538 poll, about 41, maybe 41 and a half, something like that. So those three things all suggest that it's going to be a wipeout for Democrats. And I agree. I think that's what's going to happen. What does that say about the Biden presidency? Again, here's where the binary thing comes in. There will be people who say, oh, it shows that he's a failed president. He's a wipeout. You know, he's a loser. Is going to get crushed in 2024 if he chooses to run again. And I don't think he will. And I'll bring in history again and say that the midterms actually don't mean all that much in terms of what it means for the president's potential re-election run. And I'll point to, for example, go back to the Reagan era. The 82 midterm for Ronald Reagan was a huge crushing defeat for Republicans. They got crushed in November 1982. Well, what happened just 2 years later? Reagan was reelected in a massive landslide. You can go fast forward to 1994. Bill Clinton was elected in 92, obviously. 94, he was crushed in 1994. Republicans took over the House. Newt Gingrich became the Speaker. Well, what happened 2 years after that? Clinton was reelected rather convincingly over Bob Dole. You can go into the Obama era and say that, okay, here's Obama. He's elected in 2008. He got crushed in the 2010 midterms, just slaughtered in 2010. What happened? He was elected fairly easily in 2012. And then in the Trump era, he's elected in 2016. He didn't win the popular vote, but nevertheless, he was elected. And then in 2020, of course, I'm sorry, in the 2018 midterm, the Republicans lost the 2018 midterm. It was a blue wave. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats stormed back into the House and so forth. And so there's not necessarily much you can say in terms of correlating midterm elections with how a president may do when he runs. And there was a lot actually said about this re-election over the weekend of Emmanuel Macron in France, who is facing the same kind of trouble that Biden is facing. Deeply divided, France is deeply divided country, worries about immigration and the economy and energy prices. Sounds pretty familiar, right? In fact, Macron's approval rating going into the runoff with Le Pen was about 41%, which, as I've mentioned, is about where Biden is now. And yet Macron won with 58% of the vote. I'm not saying I'm making a prediction about what may or may not happen to Biden. I'm simply saying that people should not read too much into midterms. There's no question, again, that Republicans are going to take the House in November. I'd bet the farm on it. But what that says about 2024, history suggests you shouldn't make those kind of assumptions.
Now, of course, Macron, you know, he wins, but he wins by less than what was anticipated, and he did the last time he faced Le Pen. But you had mentioned something in there, and you said that you don't think that President Biden is going to run for re-election. So what do you think 2024 looks like then, since you were throwing that out already?
Well, I think he's simply too – I thought he was too old in 2020 when he ran. He will turn 80 in November. I just think that's far too old. I think it's time for some fresh blood, and that includes the Republicans too. I don't want to have, Biden in 2024 would be just shy of his 82nd birthday. I don't want an 81-year-old guy, and Trump was born in the summer of 46. But look, I think Biden is too old. I think Trump is too old. You know, enough of these 1940s guys here. I think the country is changing rapidly. I think both parties need younger folks, both Republicans and Democrats. So I think it's time for some fresh blood on both sides.
Now, of course, it's one thing to say that it's time for it. It's another to think that that's structurally what's going to happen. Do you see there being anybody who can? I mean, I suppose on the Republican side, you have DeSantis attempting to set himself up for a position. But do you think that he could beat Trump in a primary if the two of them were to move forward? Or do you think he would even try? And then on the Biden side, do you think he's going to try to go up for re-election? And if he does, who would realistically then primary the sitting president, you think?
Well, I don't know. It's just so hard to see. I think on the Republican side, DeSantis is still a pretty young man, but he seems to be a young man in a hurry. And he may try and take on Trump. There's clearly friction between the two of them. But that being said, Trump appears to continue to have a hammerlock on most of the party. He's sitting on an enormous war chest of money that he can do pretty much anything with. Those are powerful forces that he has. And were he to get back on Twitter in the near future. We'll see what Elon Musk wants to do. The conditions are frankly in place for Trump to make another serious run at it. I think he might be challenged, DeSantis and maybe others, who knows. So that's the Republican side. On the Democratic side, I think it's a little bit murkier because there are a lot of, look, they're ambitious people on both sides of the aisle here. And I think a lot of these Democrats are kind of privately wondering, well, what's Biden going to do? And if he's going to run again, I don't think that, I think that some people would probably just sit, well, I don't know. I'll take that back. There are some Democrats who might say, you know, look, he's simply too old. He's a one-termer. He did what he was supposed to do. He came in and he got rid of Trump. Now it's time for him to just, you know, retire, go back to Delaware, you know, have a good time, and somebody else could run. But I think the people are going to wait and obviously see what the sitting incumbent president does. There was a thing in the Washington Post last week about, you know, who were the other sort of like top contenders for Biden were he to decide that he's not going to run again. It's the usual names. I mean, you know, Vice President Harris, I think, was obviously the number two person. I don't quite there. We could talk about her at length. I'm not quite sure that she has the, you know, the legs to make it all that way. Yeah. There are other Democrats who I think might be in a better position. Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, Amy Klobuchar of senator from Minnesota, that kind of thing. The governor of California is being kind of talked about. You can never discount any governor of California just because it's California, biggest state,
yeah,
one fifth of the electoral votes, and you know, and that kind of thing. So so there are certainly contenders, and if Biden decides that he's not going to run in 2024, then it's going to be just a free for all. But there are naysayers about Harris. Nevertheless, there are a lot of people who think, look, it's time for a woman, but it doesn't necessarily have to be her. Amy Klobuchar, as I mentioned, and Gretchen Whitmer, and as I mentioned, Governor Newsom out in California. So there are all kinds of, I think that's sort of the top tier of potential Democrats who would run. And all of them are kind of just, waiting in the wings, waiting to see what the president is going to do. It's way too early, but my own instinct says that he could be one and done. He's just too old.
No, I mean, and if those two individuals ran against each other, no matter who wins, we'd have the oldest president in history.
That's right. As we do now.
Yeah, true. I mean, we would be trumping it. Now, you know, you mentioned something there, and we had talked about this at the beginning of the show, and so I'd like to kind of maybe close out our time together talking a little bit about this, which is, you know, obviously this week, Elon Musk seemingly has his ducks in the row to buy Twitter. And as we talk about social media, I think Twitter is kind of firmly the centerpiece of that, followed or equal to Facebook. But there's a lot of questions of, well, how would a Musk Twitter potentially change the nature or the political landscape? As a matter of fact, you had mentioned it in your answer there that you thought that that could be a potential benefit for Trump. What do you see changing in the landscape, if anything, for Twitter and social media if Elon Musk is able to finish his purchase of Twitter?
Well, Twitter is going to have a lot of a debt on its hands, and right now its revenue model is based on advertising. So when your revenue model is dependent on advertisers coming to you, you have to behave in a certain way that's going to attract advertising. If you're very bombastic, or you have people on who are saying things that stirring the pot or just too controversial, that's the kind of thing that may scare advertisers away. So I just think we have to wait and see what he wants to do. I mean, he has said that, I think he said something the other day, that I like. He said, I want, this is what Musk said. He said, I want my critics, people who hate me and criticize me, I want them to stay on Twitter and keep criticizing me because that's what free speech is all about. That's not the exact quote, but that's the essence of what he said. I think if he means that, I think that's very encouraging. It suggests that he's going to have people on both sides, and it's a town square. You can go at it and debate all you want. Debate is quite healthy. As long as it's one, civil, and two, factual, then it's great. But once it slides into incivility and lies, things that are not factual, then of course it's not good for the country at large, and public discourse suffers, and you get into issues like disinformation and that sort of thing. So I think that if he can figure out a way to make sure or at least encourage civility and facts, and this is something that these platforms have been struggling with, trying to take off, you know, Russian bots and everything, and there have been people who've been taken off these platforms for, at least in the eyes of Twitter and Facebook, taken off for encouraging of violence and that kind of thing, and just that sort of thing. So how do you keep people like that off these platforms while encouraging free speech in general? It's the old argument about how, well, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? I mean, free speech has its limits. If it's harmful to the populace in general, is it healthy or unhealthy? I would say probably the latter. So I think public responsibility plays a role here too. You can't force people to behave, and can't force individuals to say things that are polite, but you can't keep people like that off your platform. It's sort of like you go into a 7-Eleven or a restaurant or something, the sign that says, no shoes, no shirt, no service, or whatever. Businesses, especially a private business, they have the right to do business with whoever they choose. You know, I can't go into a really good restaurant in a bathing suit and expect to be, seated. You know, restaurants, businesses, establishments, they have their own standards as they see fit and adhere to them. And if I don't like it, I can take my business elsewhere. And Twitter and Facebook and these other platforms, if that analogy holds true, they can determine who they want to do business with and who they want to have in their store, so to speak. But these are all cans of worms, and we live in this society, Trey, where people are afraid of being insulted and having what they see as their individual rights, trod upon and that kind of thing. But there's a lot, but people talk about their individual rights, but maybe there needs to be some broader focus on a broader public and civic responsibility that people should focus on, rather than just what's good for me. So I hope that makes sense, but that's sort of how I feel about all that.
No, I get that. And as a matter of fact, when you're talking about just the rights and responsibilities, the other bit to that's from my point of view, oftentimes is you have individuals who aren't even quite sure what their rights are, right? So, the right to free speech, for example, is a right to not be penalized by government. It's not necessarily the right that anybody particularly has to let you, or has to, platform you, right? As somebody who writes for a number, USA Today doesn't have to take my email ramblings and publish. Right. I don't have a right to free speech in that sense.
And you're not being censored if they don't choose to edit it, choose to run it.
Exactly.
And that's, I think you make a good point. All the First Amendment says is that, we're free to criticize the government. What the First Amendment means in essence is that the government cannot retaliate against us for criticizing the government, but that's it. The government can't throw me in jail for criticizing the government. It doesn't work that way. I lived in Russia for 5 years. It doesn't work that way in Russia. It doesn't work that way in China. We're protected by the First Amendment from government retaliation against speaking freely. But if you work, say, for the XYZ widget company, you have no similar protections. You can criticize, if you're an employee of XYZ widget company, if you criticize your own employer, you can probably expect to be fired. That's not a free speech issue. It's a private company determining who they want working for them. So I think people need to kind of understand some of these distinctions.
Well, and that's especially true when it comes to what's said on social media. I think that can be a surprise for students often that I have, is the need to think carefully about how one crafts their image, because that's what somebody is ultimately part of what they're hiring when they hire you.
Yep. Yep. So true. Yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for spending this time here on The Politics Guys and taking on questions about the presidency, about political communication. Is there any specific way for listeners who'd like to continue to follow you? Obviously, they can follow you on Twitter at West Wing Report. Are there other ways that you would like for them to connect with you?
That's really the best way. I've written several books, obviously, so maybe something might appeal to someone, but the Twitter account's probably the best way, and I thank you for mentioning it.
Okay, well, of course. Thank you so much for being on the show. Paul, thank you for joining us. I am Trey Orndorff, and the executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and our newest, Ko Lee. Today's show was produced by me, Trey Orndorff. I hope you'll join us next time. And